Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my very great pleasure to welcome you this evening to one of the school's public lectures, one of a series given annually by our visiting centennial professors. And Professor Dworkin is the BP visiting centennial professor of this year. And we're very grateful, as always, to BP for enabling us to have him with us. Professor Dworkin is a professor of philosophy, or he comes from a department of philosophy, but in the wonderful way the LSE mixes people up, he's actually been hosted by the Department of Government. I think that's very right and proper, and just a tribute to the way in which we cheerfully study the social sciences without too much recognition of the boundaries between them. It's also usual for the BP visiting centennial professor to be invited by BP to spend some time with them, although Professor Dworkin tells me that in his particular case he hasn't yet had the summons. most of his predecessors have been economists. I don't know whether they feel that philosophers would be more than usually a problem and out of their depth. However, I warn you, it might yet come. Professor Dworkin is course had a very distinguished academic career. He tells me he happened to write his PhD thesis in London, but otherwise this is his first extended visit to a British university. We're very grateful to him for having spent his time with us and eagerly looking forward to his topic, which is one that is, I suspect, going to become of increasing interest and importance as application of technology to medicine raises more acutely ethical dilemmas which in one way or another have been with us for a long time, but which only now are really beginning to impact on serious political and professional interests. So without more ado, can I invite Professor Dworkin to give us his lecture entitled May Doctors Kill, Euthanasia and the Practice of Medicine.
Thank you, Director. I want to take this occasion to thank the LSE and the government department, who didn't mix me up in the wrong sense, in particular, Brian Barry and John Charvet for the invitation to be the centennial professor and for their very kind hospitality to my wife and myself. We would also like to thank the hardworking employees of the Environmental Services Unit for their many kindnesses in connection with our stay at the Anchorage. Philosophers are often asked, what exactly is philosophy? A perfectly legitimate question, and one about which philosophers themselves have quite different views. One of my favorite characterizations is by the Columbia University philosopher Sidney Morganbesser, a man known as much for his wit as for his wisdom, who replied to one such query. You make a few distinctions, you clarify a few concepts, it's a living. My favorite definition, though, is that of Robert Nozick, who said that philosophy is the systematic examination of other people's fundamental assumptions. So tonight, as you shall see, I will try to earn a living by critically examining at least one other person's fundamental assumptions. This is part of a longer work on which I am engaged, defending the moral legitimacy of physician-assisted suicide and voluntary euthanasia, and arguing for certain changes in its current legal status. For expository purposes, I will use the term medically assisted dying to cover both physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. By physician-assisted suicide, I intend cases where the physician provides the knowledge and or means by which a competent, suffering patient who is either terminally ill or has an intractable and irremediable illness can take her own life. By euthanasia, I intend cases in which the physician performs the last causal step leading to death, most commonly by lethal injection, and can be said, therefore, to kill the patient. The starting point of my argument is the consensus, at least in the United States, that a competent patient has a right to refuse any proposed medical treatment or to withdraw from existing medical treatment, even if she knows that this will certainly result in death. This consensus has some controversy at its extreme boundaries. For example, with respect to the withdrawal of artificial feeding and hydration, but is firmly established both legally and within the medical community. The general strategy is to argue that if one accepts such a right, then one ought, in moral consistency, to accept that a patient may request physician-assisted suicide, or, in certain conditions, euthanasia, and that, under appropriate circumstances, it is permissible and ought not to be criminal for doctors to provide such assistance. Whether physicians are under an obligation to do so is a stronger claim about which, so far, I remain agnostic. The idea, then, is to consider the various arguments for supposing a normative asymmetry to exist between what has, in my view, mistakenly been called passive euthanasia, better labeled refusal of treatment, and physician-assisted suicide or active euthanasia, and to argue that such an asymmetry does not, in fact, hold. Thus far, the argument would be ad hominem, that is, proceeding from a consensus that might not be justified. But since I believe it has a valid grounding, the conclusions are intended to be justified on their own, not simply to be implications of accepted premises. The various arguments for asymmetry include a number of different arguments. One set of arguments stems from the claim that there is a morally relevant difference in intentionality and or causality, which then supposedly justifies a moral asymmetry. Falling under this heading are various views about the moral significance of distinctions such as killing versus letting die, intending versus foresight of consequences, and its associated principle of double effect, the distinction between an act and an omission, and so forth. In addition, there are arguments involving causality and its moral significance. For example, the argument that in letting die, say by disconnecting a patient from a respirator, the patient dies from his disease, whereas in killing, the doctor is the cause of death. And that this causal difference is directly or indirectly one which affects the moral quality of the two acts. A second set of arguments argues that there is a morally relevant difference in the likely consequences of the two policies. Here the main arguments are various forms of the slippery slope, thin edge of the wedge, and so forth. The claim is, even if it is true that some particular instances of medically assisted dying are permissible, once we allow these, we shall not be able to stop the progression to instances that we all recognize as abhorrent. My general view here is that the empirical evidence is lacking to substantiate such claims. And here, it's particularly relevant to look at the Dutch experience, which has been studied by social scientists for a number of years. One problem with that data is that we have no baseline to serve as a comparison. That is, if there are abuses in the Dutch system, we don't really have any way of knowing whether, in fact, they are a result of the peculiar way in which the Dutch have gone about semi-legalizing euthanasia, because we don't know what the baseline is for the practice of euthanasia in other societies, or indeed in Dutch society, before its semi-legalization. It is fairly clear that there is a fair amount of euthanasia that takes place in societies which regard it as equivalent to murder. In one survey in Australia of Victoria doctors, 29% said that they had taken active steps to bring about the death of patients who had requested this. So we don't know, as I say, whether the reported abuses in Holland represent a worsening or possibly even an improvement over the current situation. Given what I believe is the lack of empirical evidence, such arguments concerning the slippery slope often collapse into F.M. Cornford's satirical version of the wedge and dangerous precedent arguments. And the principle of the wedge, according to Cornford, is that you should not act justly now for fear of raising expectations that you may act still more justly in the future. And his version of the principle of the dangerous precedent is that you should not now do an admittedly right action for fear you or your equally timid successors should not have the courage to do right in some future case. It follows, says Cornford, that nothing should be done for the first time. There are also arguments that the distinction between refusal of treatment and medically assisted dying is important when we consider the institutionalization of medically assisted dying. The claim is that even if we thought individual instances morally permissible, it would be mistaken to have a policy which allows them. Independent of our views about the morality of instances, we ought to enforce the asymmetry by means of legal restrictions and professional norms. And here we get issues such as the possible pressures that might be put on patients to request medically assisted dying, the need to avoid fraudulence in the process, and the symbolic significance of not allowing one person to kill another. It might be worth noting that there are significantly different ways of altering the legal status quo. In addition to outright legalization, there are at least three other changes that could be made. One could maintain the existing law, which classifies euthanasia as homicide and prohibits assisted suicide, but encourage prosecutors to exercise their discretion not to prosecute. In Holland, euthanasia remains technically illegal. But there is an explicit agreement not to prosecute if physicians observe certain guidelines and report their acts to the relevant authorities. It is interesting that, actually up until this morning, there was no jurisdiction in the world which has actually, or had actually, fully legalized euthanasia. I was informed by email this morning that the Northern Territories of Australia have become the first jurisdiction to pass a bill legalizing voluntary euthanasia. Second, one could maintain the status quo, but allow as a defense to a homicide prosecution the defense of merciful motive. This would then put the burden of proof on a defendant to show that he or she acted in accordance with motives which the law recognizes as negating the criminality of the conduct. Or again, one could allow considerations of motive not as a defense to criminal charges, but as a mitigating factor in sentencing. So there are a number of different reforms that one could advocate if one wanted to advocate a change in the existing legal situation, only one of which is the sheer dropping from the criminal code of euthanasia as a form of homicide. And these various policies may have different symbolic significance, have different anticipated consequences, different possibilities for setting dangerous precedents, and so forth. Finally, we have arguments from the nature of medicine and of the profession of medicine and its norms. It is argued that these require one to make and preserve a sharp distinction between allowing patients to die, which doctors do every time, for example, they no-code a patient, which is simply doctor speak for saying that a particular patient should not receive CPR if they suffered cardiac arrest, that there's an important point in maintaining the distinction between those kinds of policies, which go on all the time, and helping them or causing them to die. And it is only this last argument that I shall be addressing tonight. The claim, summed up in the slogan, "Doctors must not kill," is widely accepted, particularly in the medical community. I want to examine it as it has received its most thorough and sophisticated defense in an article by Professor Leon Cass. To identify Cass for a non-American audience, he was actually trained as a physician, but as far as I know, never practiced, but spent his entire career teaching and writing about philosophical issues, mainly but not exclusively concerning medicine. He teaches at the University of Chicago in the Committee on Social Thought. He writes in journals that reach a wide audience. The journal in which the article I will examine appeared, The Public Interest, is a neoconservative journal of general circulation. Now, in view of the fact that I will be trying to show that his arguments are, to put it delicately, logically challenged, you should understand that I focus on them not because they are an easy target, but because this article has had such widespread influence. I have yet to find an article that is opposed to medically assisted dying in any of the very influential American medical journals, such as the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the American Medical Association, which does not cite Cass in that strange way that scientists sometimes invoke philosophical authority as, in effect, settling or proving the point at issue. Cass begins by considering the question about physicians killing as a, quote, special case of, but not thereby identical to, this general question. May or ought one kill people who ask to be killed? End quote. Note that phrase, may or ought, which will assume some importance as Cass develops his argument. They represent two distinct positions. One, that it is morally permissible for doctors to kill upon request. And second, that doctors are required to do so. The former position is considerably weaker than the latter. It is consistent with the view that doctors would not be acting wrongly to kill, that they also would not be acting wrongly if they refused to kill. It is the latter that is ruled out by the strong position that doctors are required to kill. Cass considers two kinds of reasons that are given in support of euthanasia, and the article is primarily directed towards euthanasia. Reasons which he believes reflects the two dominant approaches to medical ethics. The first type of reason is that of freedom or autonomy. And now I give a rather long quote from Cass. On this view, that is, the view which relies on considerations of freedom, physicians or others are bound to acquiesce in demands not only for termination of treatment, but also for intentional killing through poison. Because the right to choose freedom must be respected even more than life itself, and even when the physician would never recommend or concur in the choices made. When persons exercise their right to choose against their continuance as embodied beings, doctors must not only cease their ministrations to the body. By the way, Cass is not does not differ from the consensus. He believes that is perfectly legitimate when further treatment is futile to cease their ministrations to the body. Doctors must not only cease their ministrations to the bodies, as keepers of the vials of life and death, they are also morally bound actively to dispatch the embodied person. The second reason, still quoting Cass, the second reason for killing the patient who asks for death has little to do with choice. Instead, death is to be directly and swiftly given because the patient's life is deemed no longer worth living, according to some substantive or objective measure. Unusually great pain, or a terminal condition, or an irreversible coma, or advanced senility, or extreme degradation, is the disqualifying quality of life that pleads, choice or no choice, for merciful termination. It is not his autonomy, but rather the miserable and pitiable condition of his body or mind that justifies doing the patient in. Absent such substantial degradations, requests for assisted death would not be honored. Not the autonomous will of the patient, but the doctor's benevolent and compassionate love for suffering humanity justifies the humane act of mercy killing. These are the two reasons that Cass believes are inadequate to justify doctors killing. Why does he think so? His first claim is that these two views are, quote, united in their opposition to the belief that medicine is intrinsically a moral profession, with its own immanent principles and standards of conduct that set limits on what physicians may properly do. Each seeks to remedy the ethical defect of a profession seen to be in itself amoral, technically competent, but morally neutral. End of quote. But how does this follow? It is clearly open to those who support some form of medically assisted dying to believe that respecting the wishes of patients and seeking to relieve suffering are moral considerations which are part of our current understanding of the practice of medicine. They could be built into the ideals of medicine. They could be definitive of the role of physician. They could be part of the moral code that physicians are required to take and abide by when initiated into the profession. Of course, it is possible to hold that these values are external to the profession of medicine, that they are grafted on to a morally neutral technique. But nothing in the views themselves requires them to be so viewed. Proponents of medically assisted dying are not denying that principles and standards of conduct that ought to be part of our conception of a good physician set limits to what physicians may properly do. They only deny that the limits are as Cass would set them. But this is not the core of Cass's argument. He goes on to claim that if these are the reasons used to ground the permissibility of medically assisted dying, then a consistent application of them can only lead to morally repugnant views. Quote, "For the first ethical school, that is the one which relies on autonomy or freedom, the implicit and sometimes explicit model of the doctor-patient relationship is one of contract. The physician sells his services on demand. If a patient wants to fix her nose or change his gender, determine the sex of his unborn children, or take euphorian drugs just for kicks, the physician can and will go to work. For the second ethical school, not the will of the patient, but the humane and compassionate motive of the physician, not as physician but as human being, makes the doctor's actions ethical. All acts," still quoting Cass, "including killing the patient, done lovingly, are licit, even praiseworthy. Good and humane intentions can sanctify any deed. In my opinion," Cass, "each of these approaches should be rejected as a basis for medical ethics. Neither can make sense of some specific duties and restraints long thought absolutely inviolate under the traditional medical ethics. For example, the proscription against having sex with patients. Must we now say that sex with patients is permissible if the patient wants it and the price is right, or alternatively, if the doctor is gentle and loving and has a good bedside manner?" Cass's humor, not mine. Now, if the views in question had these implications, for example, that all acts done lovingly are licit, or that doctors may have sex with their patients, or that good intentions can sanctify any deed, this would surely be an important, perhaps decisive objection to such views. This, of course, assumes that proponents of medically assisted dying agree that these acts and generalizations are morally deficient. And that seems a safe enough assumption. But only an extremely bizarre understanding of the views in question could lead to the idea that such implications follow. Let me explain. First, a minor point. Note that in the presentation of the views he is attacking, Cass slips from the may or ought formulation to the strong thesis. Quote, physicians are bound to acquiesce in demands not only for termination of treatment, but also for intentional killing. Or again, doctors must not only cease their ministrations to the body, they are also morally bound actively to dispatch the embodied person, end quote. So even were his arguments good ones, at most they would show that the strong thesis, that there is a strong right to medically assisted dying, is mistaken. But the arguments are not good ones for at least two reasons. First, the argument switches targets in midstream. Second, the argument assumes that the reasons in question operate independently, each providing a sufficient reason for euthanasia. Whereas they are most naturally and plausibly understood as providing necessary conditions which in suitable circumstances may be together sufficient for making it permissible. Let me say more about each of those two points. First, the switching of targets. When Cass initially presents what he calls the second reason, that is the one in terms of quality of life considerations, it is, he says, because the patient's life is by some measure not worth living that mercy is called for. But when he gets to his counterexample of doctor-patient sex, he has dropped this condition and switched to the motives or intentions, he's never clear about the difference between the two, of the physician. It is good intentions or benevolent motives which are supposed to justify the doctor's conduct. Hence the supposed implication that if the doctor has the right motives, various unpleasant things are permissible. But this is to switch to a very different position than the one originally set out. What counts in the original view, in the original both, in the sense of this is what the proponents believe counts, and in terms of what Cass himself sets out originally, is whether the patient is, e.g., in great pain or advanced senility, etc., plus consent. Of course, if the doctor acts on the basis of these factual conditions, he will be acting benevolently. But it is the condition which justifies his acts. Although his belief that in acting he would benefit his patient and is intending to bring about that benefit characterize his motive as a benevolent one, were he mistaken in his beliefs, he would still be motivated benevolently, but nevertheless fail to act correctly. Indeed, it would be a bizarre view to suppose that good intentions can justify any deed, but that is not the view in question. Second, and crucially, Cass sets up a straw man. He considers a view which counts either choice or life not worth living, but not both as the relevant considerations. And indeed, if either of these views is considered by themselves, they could have unwanted implications. But the most plausible view is that it is both choice and condition which make a doctor's killing permissible. That is why the view is labeled voluntary euthanasia. Voluntary to indicate the choice of the patient, euthanasia to indicate that death in these circumstances is a good. And if one looks at any discussion of the subject in the legal literature, for example, say in Glanville Williams' classic treatment of the subject, he says, Whatever opinion may be taken on the general subject of suicide, it has long seemed to some people that euthanasia, the merciful extinction of life, is morally permissible and indeed, he believes, mandatory, where it is performed upon one, a dying patient, two, with his consent, and three, where it is the only way of relieving his suffering. It's the joint position. When Cass says, unusually great pain or a terminal condition, etc., is the disqualifying quality of life that pleads choice or no choice for merciful termination, he is considering a position which few, if any, hold, at least with respect to competent adults. His error emerges most obviously when he says that the position he is considering holds that, quote, it is not his autonomy, but rather the miserable and pitiable condition of his body or mind that justifies doing the patient in, absent such substantial degradations, requests for assisted suicide would not be honored. That second sentence indicates only that the condition of the patient is a necessary condition for justified medically assisted dying. It does not support the first sentence, which is the view that the condition of the patient is a sufficient condition for such assistance. Having identified such an obvious error, I was actually quite surprised and puzzled as to why Cass would make it, or why others hadn't at least caught it before publication. But I assumed that this was a one-off. To my further surprise and puzzlement, I ran across a variation of the same mistake in an article by Daniel Callahan, another extremely influential participant in bioethical discussions in the United States. Callahan is the founder and director of the Hastings Center, the oldest and preeminent bioethical research center in the United States. In an article attacking medically assisted dying and euthanasia called When Self-Determination Runs Amok, Callahan says the following. The two standard motives for euthanasia and assisted suicide are said to be our right of self-determination and our claim upon the mercy of others, especially doctors, to relieve our suffering. These two motives are typically spliced together and presented as a single justification. So at least Callahan got that right. But he then goes on to say, yet, if they are considered independently, and there is no inherent reason why they must be linked, they reveal serious problems. Well, of course they're not inherently linked, on some understanding of inherently. It is just that they are both required to make the moral case sound. Compare someone arguing against the position that it is legitimate for you to destroy my painting only if, one, I give you permission, and two, it is not a great work of art. And they argue against this view on the ground that when these reasons are considered independently, and there is no inherent reason why they must be linked, they reveal serious problems. For example, you can destroy any of my paintings as long as they are not great works of art. Or you can destroy the only surviving Rembrandt because it's mine and I give you permission to do so. Now, it still, therefore, remains a puzzle now why two intelligent writers on this topic commit the same logical mistake. My own speculation is that they are looking down the road, so to speak, and anticipating that the proponents of medically assisted dying will seek to extend the arguments to cases in which only one reason is operable. For example, euthanasia of severely defective newborns for whom the notion of consent obviously makes so no sense. And they read the extension back into the original position. But it is important to see that even if one were inclined to extend the argument in this fashion, one need not believe that only one of these reasons provides a sufficient justification on its own. The kinds of reasoning that govern our interaction with individuals who cannot and will never be able to give consent are likely to be sufficiently different that it will not be just a matter of dropping one consideration as not appropriate. To return to Cass, every claim he makes is mistaken. It is not the case that the views in question must view medicine as a morally neutral position. He introduces the position to be evaluated as the view that doctors may or ought to kill, but then considers only the stronger view. He introduces one of the two views as concerned with the quality of life of the patient, but then switches to a view concerned with the physician's motives or intentions. And finally, and most egregiously, he considers the views as operating independently of each other as opposed to operating jointly. Let us consider whether his further arguments fare better. He begins a discussion of what he calls professing ethically by claiming that medicine is a profession which is an inherently ethical activity in which technique and conduct are both ordered in relation to an overarching good, the naturally given end of health. A very Aristotelian position, and Cass actually thinks of himself as an Aristotelian. Every profession, in Cass's view, has a goal, and from the goal of medicine, which is preserving and restoring health, we can, quote, infer the importance of certain negative duties formulable as absolute and unexceptionable rules. This is Cass. Among these, I submit, is the rule doctors must not kill. End of quote. Before considering the arguments for this inference, it is crucial to note that a fundamental assumption is being passed over without discussion. It is assumed that each profession has a single, exclusive end that orders it. Cass speaks of, quote, an overarching good, the naturally given end of health, the profession's goal, the good to which the medical profession is devoted is health, end quote. And his example from other professions reinforce this assumption. He speaks of the teacher's goal as assisting the learning of the young. The lawyer's goal is rectifying injustice for his client. Do we have some cynics in the audience? The clergyman's is tending the souls of his parishioners. It is true that Cass seems to qualify this assumption by asserting that, quote, health is difficult to attain and preserve, so the physician is called to serve the goal of health while also ministering to the needs and relieving the sufferings of the frail and particular patient, end quote. But relieving suffering is not presented as a goal or even part of the goal of medicine, but rather as a concession to the fact that physicians and patients are finite and frail. So in considering his arguments, we must keep in mind how they would fare under the alternative assumption that medicine, like law, like teaching, like the priesthood, have multiple and sometimes conflicting ends. That just as lawyers not only seek to rectify injustice for their clients, they also advise their clients on how to conduct their affairs, advise them on when to accept settlements, negotiate for their clients. So doctors not only seek to preserve and restore the health of their patients, but seek to alleviate their suffering, comfort them when this is not possible, and, I would argue, may aid them in their effort to have the kind of death that they would prefer. It should be noted, parenthetically, how narrow Cass's conception of medicine is, quite independently of the normative points that he wants to make. For example, it would exclude aiding a woman giving birth, for that does not cure illness or preserve function. And if one adds on an ad hoc basis to these already given conceptions an idea, say, of facilitating natural processes of the body, then one has to find a way of stopping short of allowing as legitimate the facilitating of what, after all, is in some sense a natural process of dying. The next argument Cass presents is based on the excesses to which any profession is prone. Quote, "The wise setting of boundaries is based on discerning the excesses to which power unrestrained is prone. Applied to the professions, this principle would establish strict outer limits, indeed inviolable taboos, against those occupational hazards to which each profession is especially prone." End quote. As applied to medicine, Cass argues that there are special temptations to which physicians are vulnerable. Patients divulge private and intimate details of their lives to physicians. They expose their naked bodies to the physician's gaze, and they entrust their lives to the physician's skills and judgment. Thus, as the Hippocratic Oath indicates, there are specific restrictions to counter these temptations, according to Cass. No breach of confidentiality, to guard against the power that's inherent in the fact that patients divulge various details of their lives. No sexual relations with patients. No dispensing of deadly drugs. I will not comment on the first two prohibitions, namely no breach of confidentiality, no sexual relations with patients, except to note that at least the first, the restriction involving absolute confidentiality, is thought to have exceptions. For example, in the famous Tarasoff case in California, it was held that a physician to whom the patient confided that he would be, in fact, attempting to kill someone, and who, in fact, in the circumstances, did nothing to warn either the victim or the authorities, that in such circumstances, the reasonable policy would be for physicians to have a limited right to breach confidentiality. So, I mean, the first is certainly not absolute. And the second, a ban on sexual relationships with those with whom one interacts professionally, applies to many professions other than medicine. For example, teachers who are not normally exposed to the naked body of their clients. And in both cases, while the prohibitions are plausible, they are grounded in considerations which seem to me quite different than the temptations of the professional or the imbalances of power. In the case of confidentiality, there are good consequentialist reasons for such confidentiality. For example, the need for the patient, particularly, for example, in psychiatric contexts, to feel free to reveal intimate and embarrassing details which are relevant to their treatment. And in the second case, there's a general case to be made in terms of the interference of erotic feelings with the various goals of whichever profession is in question. What is striking, however, is the difference between the third inviolable taboo, that is, doctors must not kill, and the other two. For it seems to me here that the issue of temptation is just irrelevant. Surely doctors are not tempted to kill their patients. If anything, the temptation is to keep them alive beyond the point at which anything useful can be done. And this is tempting not necessarily for financial reasons, as cynics might put it, but really for psychological reasons. That is, there is always the reluctance of a professional to accept the fact that they are defeated, that there's nothing more they can do for their client. And so it seems to me, if there is a temptation which must be guarded against, in physicians. And if one has to design restrictions to guard against such temptations, it will be the temptation to do more for the patients than would actually be warranted in the situation. As for the asymmetry of power, this is correct. But notice that it is a perfectly general asymmetry. That is, the doctor knows more than her patient about drugs, about surgical techniques, about side effects, and so forth. Not only is the patient's life in the hands of the physician, but so is his body and his future capacities. So a prohibition based on the asymmetry of power and knowledge would not simply prescribe the dispensing of deadly drugs, but, for example, drugs that might have very serious side effects. It would prescribe the use of surgical techniques which require mutilation of the body, such as amputation. Now, it might be argued in response to this that all of these can be justified in terms of serving the ends of the health of the patient, whereas the dispensing of deadly drugs, for example, has no such rationale. But then we return to the worry I mentioned earlier about the initial assumption with which Cass begins, which is that medicine has as a single goal the preservation of the health of the patient. It is interesting as a matter of historical record to note that while the Hippocratic Oath does indeed forbid the physician to, quote, administer a poison to anyone when asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a course. By the way, those who invoke the Hippocratic Oath often do so on a rather selective basis. They never quote the bit about not performing surgery or not charging for the education of the children of one's colleagues. But in any case, it's quite true that that prescription on the use of a deadly poison is in the Hippocratic Oath. But the World Medical Association, for example, has, as of 1949, adopted quite a different code, which says only that, quote, any act or advice which could weaken physical or mental resistance of a human being may be used only in his interest, end quote. And this seems to me compatible with medically assisted dying, modulo an argument that, for example, death can never be in a patient's interest. But I have argued in another essay called Reflections on the Hypodermic Needle that it is not compatible with the role of a doctor as executioner in states which use lethal injection as the method of capital punishment. My argument in that situation is that it is normatively desirable to have a conception of the physician as always an ally of the patient. But acting as an agent of the state against the will of the patient to live is clearly inconsistent with such a role. So I do believe that in those circumstances, doctors must not kill. And indeed, for better or worse, even the AMA has taken this position, the American Medical Association. But I think the argument is sound quite independently of one's views about the legitimacy of, say, capital punishment. Even defenders of capital punishment can and should distinguish the roles of executioner and physician. It is because I see no similar inconsistency with the idea of the doctor as ally of the patient. Indeed, it is because I see medically assisted dying as being an instantiation of such a role that I am allowed to hold that doctors may not kill in one case, but not the other, and be consistent. Cass's final argument rests on an analogy with the role of the teacher or parent. Since the task of the teacher is to provide the occasion for learning and understanding, it follows that, quote, the teacher ought never to impose himself to the student's effort to learn or even to his prospect for learning. Even when the recalcitrant student refuses to make the effort, the teacher does not abandon his post but continues to look for a way to arouse, to cajole, to inspire, to encourage. And similarly for Cass, the true parent refuses, quote, to surrender or abandon the child, knowing that it would be deeply self-contradictory to deny the fact of one's parenthood, whatever the child may say or do. Sophie Cass, in a similar or analogous fashion, the doctor must never accept the death of the patient. Arguments from analogy are notoriously prone to misuse, and these seem to me no exception. The use of the teacher analogy depends upon agreement that it is impermissible for a teacher to, quote, abandon his post. But surely this is mistaken. If a student genuinely does not wish to continue receiving instruction, if a student prefers to improve, say, his body rather than his mind, it is no part of my responsibility as his teacher to insist upon continuing instruction. Only a fanatic would regard himself as having betrayed his profession by abandoning his post. But the deeper problem with this argument from an analogy is that its conclusion would be too strong for Cass himself. For if the doctor really ought never to surrender or abandon his patient, then the implication is that the doctor not only ought not to kill, but also not to withhold or withdraw treatment as long as there is any possibility for continued life. And this is a conclusion that, as I said earlier, Cass himself rejects. Some points in conclusion. First, even if one thought better of these arguments than I do, they have as their target voluntary euthanasia. The very title, Why Doctors May Not Kill, shows that they don't have primary relevance to physician-assisted suicide, where the doctor does not kill, but assists the patient in killing herself. Now, I actually believe that the spirit of Cass's argument ought to be as opposed to physician-assisted suicide as well, but those who put more weight than I do on the importance of the distinction in causal role of the physician in physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, between physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, that is, put more significance in the fact that in euthanasia, the doctor himself performs the last causal act in the chain leading to death, whereas in physician-assisted suicide, the patient always is the one who takes the pills or what have you. If you believe that that distinction has more weight than I do, you could, even modulo Cass's arguments, still support physician-assisted suicide. Second, it should be noted that Cass's arguments for incompatibility between the role of physician and the practice of medically assisted dying are quite distinct from others that have been put forward. His are, in a certain way, a priori. They proceed from an analysis of the concept of a physician or the nature of medicine. Other critics have focused more on, say, the possibility of damaging psychological effects if we allow this practice, for example, the breakdown of trust between doctors and patients. And those arguments are clearly different arguments. They are clearly, at least in large part, empirical claims. And the disputes will be about whether there are empirical grounds for warranting such fears. Finally, any such arguments about the nature of a profession and its norms seem capable only of establishing rather weak conclusions, namely, that if medically assisted dying is permissible, and if the current norms of the profession forbid it, then either we should change the norms of the profession and its current understandings, or the acts in question should be done by those other than physicians. I think there are actually reasons to favor having doctors be the agents of such assistance. The doctor will at least ideally, perhaps this is much too idealistic, have some kind of long-term relationship with the patient. He will, in any case, have had to advise the patient about prognosis, possible treatment, possible side effects of treatments, when and what the end of life will look like. And therefore, there is some kind of psychological continuity in having the doctor be both advisor and agent. As I say, I think there are reasons to favor doctors providing this assistance, but it would still seem to me an advance over the current situation if there were a corps of medical technicians who actually carried out these tasks. The philosophical point, however, is that arguments about the role of a physician or the aims of medicine cannot settle the permissibility of the actions at issue. For if we have good reason for thinking them permissible and desirable, then these can also serve as reasons for changing our conceptions of the role of the doctor or of the nature of medicine from its traditional and current understandings. No number of invocations of the Hippocratic Oath, nor the norms currently part of our understanding of the practice of medicine, can substitute for the normative investigation that I have hoped to contribute to this evening. Thank you.